Lee Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear Hazel Rowley, author of Tête-à-Tête, Simone de Beauvoir, and Jean-Paul Sartre. Rowley, a distinguished biographer, discusses her book with Linda Opes, legendary producer of such films as Sleepless in Seattle. Together, they offer an intimate look at one of the world's most unconventional love stories. This program was originally produced on May 1st, 2006. Please welcome Hazel Rowley and Linda Opes.
Thank you very much for coming. May the 1st, protest day.
Yes, Sartre would have loved it, you know? words are action, right? I read that
exactly.
He said. So, would have been a good day for Sartre, and he would not have been afraid of coming downtown, as you were not. So, we commend you through him. I loved this book. It is stupendously written. You are unable to put it down. And before we begin our very juicy conversation tonight, I want to ask you how this book was received among other Sartre fans besides myself. Did you receive any flack for writing such an incredibly honest portrayal of this relationship?
Oddly not. Oddly, I think the people who like it most are the people who liked Beauvoir and Sartre. Because there has been quite a controversial reception. Some of the reviewers have called them monstrous, and some of them have also, I mean, some of them have got stuck into Sartre and Beauvoir, and some of them have got stuck into me as well. They were a very controversial couple. And, of course, some reviewers review books for completely the wrong reasons before they even read the book. They hate Beauvoir and Sartre, who, after all, broke all sorts of taboos. And so they want this book to review, and they've decided in advance that they're going to slam it. So that's happened a bit. It has had a polarized reception.
Well, I'm quite fascinated in the nature of the relationship between the two of them, not necessarily just in their taboo breaking, but more in the bond, the so-called pact that the two of them had together, because I grew up idolizing the relationship they had together, with de Beauvoir being an idol of mine and sort of the symbol of liberated woman, as it were. And then the more you read the book, the more you understand, I think, the complexity and the compromises, I think, that were at play in this relationship. But at the same time, it was, in the end, de Beauvoir who mourned Sartre. Let's talk about the beginning of the relationship between Sartre and de Beauvoir. When they met, was it love? Was it a marriage of equals, even though these two clearly never got married and never had a home together?
Simone de Beauvoir hesitated when she first met Sartre. She met him in the summer of 1929, and they were both preparing for a really difficult competitive exam in philosophy, and that was back in the 1920s. If you were really bright, the subject that you did was not business management. It was philosophy, la philosophie. And so that this competitive exam in philosophy really was the toughest in the country. And they were both preparing for it. And Sartre suggested that she join the little group of men that his friends, and that they swatted for the exam together. And she fell in love. She fell in love with his generosity and with his humor and with his remarkable capacity for communicating very difficult ideas, very generously and very amusingly. When he taught philosophy at high schools for years, his students say the same. He'd sit in front of the class with his little legs swinging off the table in sort of sports jackets, which nobody wore in those days, and he was incredibly amusing. He had the whole philosophy class in fits of laughter, which generally philosophy teachers don't have. No, I think, to answer your question, she fell in love with a man who was allowing her to lead the life she hardly dared to imagine herself leading, because I just want to quickly remind people that 1929 in France, women did not have the vote. women were not allowed entrance to the École Normale Supérieure. The elite institutions of learning were for men only. Women in the middle class, like Beauvoir, if you wanted a good bourgeois marriage, it didn't matter how beautiful you were or how educated you were, you had to have a dowry. And her father had lost his money during the First World War, so she didn't have a dowry. So her father said, "You're never going to marry a good man, a really good marriage. You're going to have a career." This was a terrible failure. She said it was, in retrospect, the best thing that happened to her. So, I mean, she met this man, and I don't even need to tell you, do I, about the sexual double standard, which lasted, by the way up until the late 60s. But, you know, men sowed their wild oats, and Sartre and his friends at the École Normale Supérieure all went with prostitutes. Simone de Beauvoir was a good virgin when she met Sartre. We all know how sullied women were, and if they weren't married, they were on the shelf, all those ghastly terms. They were spinsters. And so she was with a man who was not offering her marriage, and I think she was very daring because she knew that she would be pitied by her parents, by her friends. She did not have social respect by having an open relationship with a man. She had far more to deal with than Sartre did. I mean, French men today all have mistresses. It's nothing for men to do this, but for a woman to do that back in 1929. So I answered at great length, but I just wanted to say I think she was tremendously daring, and she loved the fact that Sartre said to her, "I want you to lead a life as freely as I do. You go out and have adventures." How many men say that, by the way? How many men have said that to you? "I'll go out and have adventures, and we'll come back and we'll talk about them together as writers."
Now, let's talk about Sartre for a second, and then we'll talk about de Beauvoir. He fancied himself an extraordinary ladies' man and, of course, became an incredible ladies' man. And we're going to talk a great deal about his power over women, his need to control women, and his astonishing success with women. But he was actually quite ugly, mm-hmm. and fat and ugly and repulsive to the woman he was most obsessed with, Wanda, right? And yet he conquered them all. And the harder they fought him, the more he pursued them. And always he won them. Now, what is the nature of this obsession to win women with Sartre? What drove him to this obsessive desire to win every woman and yet keep the beaver, as he named de Beauvoir, always as the necessary as opposed to one of the many contingent, as we'll talk about? I'm going to isolate this notion of necessary and contingent relationships as Sartre sold to Beauvoir. As the nature of their pact. What drove Sartre to be this lover of so many women, one for each country, so many simultaneously? What do you think was at the root of this obsession? Was it his ugliness?
She's giving you the negative version. I'll give you the... You can tell from the way she's phrasing the questions
that it fascinates me.
So I'm going to...
Makes me a little angry.
Yes, I can tell. I think we can tell. Thank you, Linda.
No, I don't mean to editorialize.
Well, the thing is that I don't say these things in the book.
She doesn't. I
don't judge in the book at all, so I really should refuse to answer the question because my aim in the book is to let you judge, and I just want to tell a damn good story and give you the facts.
Let me rephrase the question. I'm going to read your brilliant sentence, okay, and then ask you a better question.
I think it's an excellent question, by the way. I was just pointing out to the audience that it's slightly biased.
It was. I'll phrase it better, okay? This is Hazel's brilliant sentence, okay? In everything he read, from Greek myths, classical tragedies, 19th century novels, to the swaggering detective novels he devoured, one after the other, the lone male hero steered his way through treacherous obstacles, the most dire of which were women. Sartre was determined, he wrote, to avoid this trap himself. Did he?
Okay, well, I think it's a very interesting question, really. I was just teasing. And I think the answer is that Sartre really did have a crisis about feeling ugly. He talks about discovering this when he was 12, that he was ugly. And I haven't met anybody who says that he wasn't. I mean, he was 5'1", and that's not so bad for a Frenchman as it would be for... But anyway, I hope this isn't being taped. He had the worst aspect was that he had wall eyes, so he had eyes that went in different directions. And you know, he had very bad teeth, and he really was not a handsome man. But he was an existentialist, or at least he became one. The term was, of course, his, which in a nutshell means that you are you choose what you're going to do with your life. You are constrained by your physical appearance and by your class and by your social conditions and by history, but within a certain framework you have a margin of freedom. Now, he could see around him his handsome friends, because all his friends were handsome. They had to be, otherwise they weren't his friends, because he said, if there's one thing worse than being ugly, it's being too ugly. So he made sure that everybody who he was with ever was beautiful. But he made an existential choice, which was to realize that he couldn't easily seduce women by his looks, but this wouldn't stop him seducing women. And so he chose the alternative, which was to use his language and his literary powers. He talks about seduction being rather like sort of writing literature. You have to be very good at the viewpoint. You have to know when to listen and when to talk and how to use pauses. And he really worked at seduction. Sometimes it took him 2 years. What would have taken a more handsome man one night? But he did succeed, and I think this is a very interesting thing for men to hear. He listened. He listened to women, and he made them feel important. He made them feel interesting.
And he gave them jobs.
And, of course, he did a lot for them. He wasn't just a rake who seduced and walked off. Once he did seduce a woman, he felt rather grateful to them for succumbing, and he kept them. He maintained them right. For the rest of their days.
Right. All of them simultaneously?
A whole harem of them. He was actually a rich man who died poor because he kept so many women.
So in what sense was the beaver necessary and they were contingent if he was supporting all of them?
Well, the deal he had with Simone de Beauvoir, who was called the Beaver, because her name was so like the English word beaver, but in French they always called her Le Castor, meaning the beaver in French. She worked like a beaver and so on. I think she was essential to him. She was a sort of mother figure. She was the woman, I mean, she was his intellectual equal. She was the only woman who was his intellectual equal. He usually went for younger women who were pretty. A lot of them were actresses because he wrote a lot of plays. And so he moved quite a bit in the theatre world. Whereas Simone de Beauvoir, she read everything he wrote. She edited it brilliantly. She, you know, she was a foil for his ideas. She listened to him. She corrected him. They bounced off each other. And it was very exciting.
And he told her everything and lied to the others. And right. Isn't that so interesting? Because I found it riveting that he taught her to look at things squarely in the face, which turned out to be ultimately a component of existentialism, wasn't it? Was this ability to look at self-deception as a form of phenomenology, to sort of look at the self-accounting as a form of the accounting of a thing itself, where you have to account for every single painful detail in your self-accounting. And that ultimately affected her novel writing, didn't it, when she started writing about their own lives as their own narrative, and looking at everything squarely in the face didn't make every character in their lives quite as happy as it might have.
I think it's important to remember that they sort of came out of an era that we would call Victorian, you know, before the 1920s. France, like England, was a sort of Victorian atmosphere of hypocrisy. Things happened behind closed doors, you know, and they were the generation who were going to look things in the face and say things as they were and call a spade a spade. For Simone de Beauvoir, who came out of this very conventional, double-standard Catholic world, this was tremendously refreshing to meet Sartre and have him say, We will tell each other everything, and we will never lie to each other or about things. It's important for intellectuals to look beyond the surface, to probe things, to question, to challenge, to see things as they really are and to show them that way to our readers.
But isn't it the essential contradiction that I think you probe in the book so magnificently in their relationship, and there are so many contradictions that she discovered in her later work in feminism, but isn't one of the profound contradictions in the book, as she later talks about sovereignty for the independent woman, and you talk about the two of them being equals, and that's what makes them unique in all their relationships, that you write that 6 months into their relationship, she finds that she's lost herself in the relationship entirely. She writes about a woman falling in love and losing herself completely in the relationship, suddenly finding that she's reading the same books that her lover reads and seeing the same landscapes that her lover sees and loving the same friends and suddenly having the same enemies and finding that she has no identity. Is this something that de Beauvoir struggled with throughout her relationship with Sartre?
I think she always struggled with that whenever she fell in love. It wasn't just with Sartre. And I think this is one of the interests of my book, I hope, is that I show them as profoundly human, whereas, you know, reviewers either like to see them as, you know, it's sacred or else sacred monsters, whereas I show them, I think, quite tenderly as being very insecure, both of them in their way, and vulnerable, and both of them in love. You see them eternally waiting for letters from their lovers, you know, when they were on their travels in Rome or in the north of Africa, or they were kept going to the poste restante to hope to find a letter, you know, from the people they were writing to, and often they didn't and they went mad. Yeah, she writes very movingly. There's a chapter in The Second Sex called The Woman in Love, and she talks about how this woman can lose herself in the man. Because you see, an existentialist, a true existentialist, is meant to be accountable. You're meant to be accountable for your own life. You mustn't rely on any other force. You don't use God as an excuse. First of all, there is no such thing as God for an existentialist. It's the individual self who is the center of your moral universe. And you mustn't rely on another person, whether it's, you know, Mussolini or some leader or your husband, to tell you what to do. You have to be your own moral person. And part of her essay, The Second Sex, is to show the complicity of women in their own oppression. She talks about the narcissist or the woman in love, or you know, the tremendously religious woman who always looks to somebody else to, and all she's doing is sort of slip into the shoes and taking orders, whereas the good, transcendent, existential subject has to be responsible to herself and her own moral standards.
You know, because we were talking, I found quite fascinating the pattern of her evolution as a libertine, as it were. And we were talking, I wondered throughout the evolution of her bisexuality in the book. She begins to have affairs with women, as he begins to have affairs with women, about the genuine nature of her bisexuality, whether she was doing this to titillate Sartre, to intrigue Sartre, to bring him closer to her, or whether this was really her own impulse. I mean, I know this is sort of a pop psychologizing thing that one does when one reads a book like this, and you did not indulge in this most American of all habits. But it felt to me, for example, you did note that when she was with other men, when she was with Bost or when she was with Algren, she played down her bisexuality and her affairs with women. But when she was with Sartre, she played it up. And often she got involved with people who Sartre was involved with, clearly entangling herself with Sartre as opposed to trying to get Sartre jealous or bring him out of his relationships. So there seemed to be a clear sort of Sartre reason for that entanglement. And then with Bienenfeld, this young student of hers, this lovely young student who both Sartre got involved with after she got involved, it sort of had no good end at all because she had a little nervous breakdown because they were both parental figures, which she beautifully took responsibility for later when she came to realize its impact. You could see that there was both a parental and a some kind of psychosexual involvement of the both of them in that. And it didn't really somehow ever feel like a sort of genuinely erotic thing as opposed to a sort of warm motherly thing. It seemed that she was... Am I just making this up, Hale?
Well, no, I think it was, I think it was erotic. And, I mean, I think this is the thing about me not putting any of that kind of analysis in the book is that it actually does make you want to do it because I don't do it for you. And I think I think it's a very interesting question. You're right that... But don't forget, actually, that Simone de Beauvoir mostly got involved with the young women before Sartre did. What happened was that Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre were both teachers of philosophy for about 10 years before they became full-time writers. And both of them were hugely charismatic in front of their classes. And Simone de Beauvoir would come into her philosophy class at the baccalaureate level, you know, the top level. And she was very beautiful. Wore her hair up mostly and wore makeup, which most women teachers didn't do back then. They were kind of blue stocking-ish. And she would also never use notes, and she'd stand at the front of the class and teach them this wonderful stuff, but also making a bit of reference to her own life and letting these girls understand that she had a boyfriend, she wasn't married, and that she'd lived for a year in Marseille all by herself and sat in cafes to write books. And so they very quickly became utterly fascinated by this woman, and they fell in love with her. I mean, a whole chain of them. And really, I think it was that the girls threw themselves at Simone de Beauvoir. They perhaps saw their own, they perhaps smelt freedom through her. That's actually what she herself says at one point. I don't think they're in love with me, they're in love with the freedom I represent. But anyway, so she became involved with them. You know, it went from sort of listening to jazz together to kissing each other to actually going to bed together. And then, and this happened three times with her ex, her former students. They had at least stopped being students when she did this, but only barely. And then Sartre moved in on their relationship three times, Olga, Vanda, and Bianca. And he then tried to seduce the young woman and nearly always succeeded except in one case. And it was very difficult because mostly they formed a kind of trio. And Simone de Beauvoir didn't like it. Because Sartre was very maniacal about it all. He saw seduction and love as being a power thing. Mm-hmm. And so, and I do agree with you, Linda, that I mean, she certainly herself thought that the real thing was heterosexuality and that homosexuality was only, it wasn't as exciting was how she saw it. And I really don't know what to make of that because... In the letters to Sartre, she writes about having pretty heated nights with these women. So I don't know whether she was just being rather conventional and saying that the real thing, I don't know what to make of it. But in any event, to her, it was the real thing was men. But she nevertheless very much enjoyed the company of women. And there's no doubt that she enjoyed going to bed with beautiful young women. And for one more reason, I think it made her feel like Sartre. Himself, mm-hmm. And she quite liked feeling like a man sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can understand why, in terms of how he sort of enjoyed the hunt so much.
Yes.
And she saw women as prey.
Yes.
As so much of the time. So to be in the position of not being prey must be a relief.
Yes.
When she was seeing him always put women in the position of being at a loss and being as prey.
Well, we should just explain freedom. That these were rather young women, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 years younger at least and more later. And therefore, they were women who were a little bit out of their depth with these very charismatic figures. And so there is a slightly worrying element about all this. I mean, the young women agreed to it. They wanted it. But there was a bit of sort of power stuff going on, which isn't very pleasant, really.
Well, there was a lot of power stuff in all of his sort of sexuality, which is, I think, compensatory for his height and for his ugliness and all of that other stuff that we've begun to talk about. But on a more pleasant note, tell me about great dinners among the whole gang leading to these fiestas. There was a time, and part of what we have to realize, too, is that all of this was experimental, right? This was, I mean, really the avant-garde, right? So we were making, they were making this up as it went along. I have a little sense of this because I was around in the 60s where we were making things up as they went along. And we didn't know what the sort of implications of our experiments were. Do you know? No one knew that speed killed, for example, right?
Right.
You find that out, no one takes speed anymore, right?
Or they do, and they learn it all over again. I do think we have to just remember that the 1920s, people were a lot, there were a lot of open relationships about. I mean, Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre were by no means the only couple who had many other lovers. I mean, the world today has become morally and sexually a great deal more conservative,
right,
not just in the 60s, but also than the 20s, 30s, and 40s. So, but I think what was so original...
We'll all go back.
What was so original about... Well, it was before AIDS. It was before so many things. But what was so original about them was the fact that they were just so much a couple of writers who told each other everything and lived partly through each other. And how many people tell each other everything when they have an open relationship? You know, it can be rather hairy.
And they withstood it all of these years.
Yeah.
And they had a group of very close friends, and they all lived in hotels. Few of them had homes, and they all had relationships with one another, and they had dinner together. It actually sounds quite fun, although it got a bit hairy after a while because there were many too many internecine relationships, but they managed to stay friends, didn't they?
And
sisters and brothers and sisters having relationships and sisters, and I mean, not with each other, but with other people's relationships.
Yes, there was a whole incestuous aspect to it. I just wanted to comment briefly on the hotels, which were, I mean, I went to France. I saw the tail end of that period when French hotels were really something quite different from what they are now. And the hotels, you see, they rented a room for the month, and it was cheap. It was a cheap way to live, and they could eat out in cafes and so on. But these hotels were unheated. For example, during the war, during the occupation, the Nazi occupation of Paris, it just so happens that those 4 winters were 4 of the most extreme winters that Paris has ever known. And they lived in hotels that were unheated. So Simone de Beauvoir writes in her memoirs about, you know, getting under the duvet, but also, you know, in her ski trousers, in her woolen underwear. And that's why it helped to have a lover or so to wrap yourself around. And they went to write in the daytime in cafes because these cafes were heated. You know, they had a coal pot belly stove in the middle of the cafe floor, which was heated by black market coal that the owner managed to procure. So that's why they worked in cafes. They also liked the bustle of life around them. And it was quite possible in those days to sort of order a cup of coffee or tea every 4 hours and otherwise sit and write.
You're doing that now at Starbucks and all the cafes
right.
all over Los Angeles.
Starbucks isn't quite the same as the floor.
You don't think? It's as close as we can come in Los Angeles, I think.
Right. But you, to comment on your other question about the sort of incestuous quality, it's true that they did tend to, Sartre didn't, so Beauvoir had this relationship with a Russian-born pupil of hers called Olga, and the two started to go to dances and nightclubs together and kiss and so on and go to bed occasionally. Sartre moved in on the relationship. It became the most harrowing trio. And Simone de Beauvoir wrote her first novel in French called L'Invité, in English translated as She Came to Stay. The actual translation means the guest, but I mean, this particular guest stayed too long was the implication. And I think Beauvoir wrote about it because it was the first time in her life that she had a subject which was about life being extremely harrowing. I mean, the trio was a very harrowing experience. Olga never agreed to go to bed with Sartre. She found him somewhat disgusting, and she told him so frequently. You know, he had blackheads, he had greasy hair, he bathed once a week. By the way, that was the other thing about French hotels at the time. Don't imagine that they had bathrooms and toilets. They had what they called a Turkish toilet down the end of the corridor. Do any of you know those things that were just two footprints in a hole? That's what you... Much more difficult for women than for men.
Not the George Sank.
Not the George Sank style today. And there was a cold water basin. So if you wanted a bath, you had to find somewhere else to go. That was, you know, the washing habits of the French at those times. So Olga never consented to go to bed with Sartre. So eventually she went off with another man. And Sartre moved in on Olga's sister, her younger sister. So there was this quality that Linda was talking about sisters. And there was one other example of that. When Simone de Beauvoir was 42, I think it was, she fell in love with Claude Lanzmann, the documentary maker, the famous filmmaker who did Shoah. And he was 27 at the time, she was 42. And they had a very romantic relationship. There's a picture of them both in the book looking really gorgeous. And he actually moved in with her, which is something that Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre never did. They never lived together, Beauvoir and Sartre. They always lived, you know, hotels, different floors, or apartments a few blocks away. Whereas Claude Lanzmann moved in with Simone de Beauvoir. And so what did Sartre do this time? He didn't obviously want to go to bed with Claude Lanzmann. So he went to bed with Claude Lanzmann's younger sister, Evelyn. So that makes a rather interesting chapter, that one. She was, of course, gorgeous.
He did a little damage there, didn't he? Ah, just a little. But they were all very involved with each other because of, I think, the charismatic vortex at the middle. No one could really leave the circle completely.
Yes.
Because it was an intoxicating circle. I myself would like to join the circle, but they're gone.
Exactly. No, that's right. It was a bit like the Communist Party used to be in the 30s. I mean, people didn't want to leave it because their entire social life crumbled. Mm-hmm. And this circle was very mesmerizing, with mm-hmm. Sartre and Beauvoir at the middle of it, exerting a tremendous fascination, yes.
And when Sartre and Du Beauvoir would make these, in the nature of these pacts, he would go off, I mean, at different stages of their life, their separations would be for various amounts of time, but no matter what other people they would be involved with, they would always spend a period of time together during the year. Mm. How did their other relationships feel about the nature of their relationship?
Well, Sartre wasn't absolutely truthful about Simone de Beauvoir, and I think this was one of the things that really hurt her, was that later on he would go for, say, 2 weeks with Vanda, and then followed by 3 weeks with Michel, and then Sartre and Beauvoir would spend 6 weeks together in Rome. And then they'd go back to Paris. But when he was with Beauvoir or when he was with Michel, he didn't necessarily tell that to the other women. I mean, he was such an amazing liar.
He was a brilliant juggler. He could have been an agent.
He went to enormous lengths to tell lies, too, and he was sort of proud of it, you know. I mean, it was not terribly different from him, for him, than writing a novel, telling a story. And, you know, he even got people to post letters, to mail letters to girlfriends. If he was off with one and they thought he was at this place, he would ask a friend who was at that place to mail a daily letter off to her. So, I mean, this was quite difficult, therefore, for this woman, young woman, to discover his lies, because he really went about it in a very systematic way.
It was Wanda, however. Was it Wanda that always hated de Beauvoir the most? Because she somehow knew the truth, that she was the one that would never leave.
They all seemed to hate Simone de Beauvoir,
which,
underneath it, they felt that she was a sort of mother-in-law figure. I should say that they only slept together for 7 years, Beauvoir and Sartre, and then the affair stopped being sexual. And it remained very intimate, but they didn't share a bed. And I think this explains certain things. I mean, it makes it easier to be not jealous if it's not a sexual relationship.
One more question, one more point about him, and then I want to talk about de Beauvoir's philosophy about women and aging and women in general, which we talked about, which is such a crisis.
Sober subject.
Yes, that doesn't seem to go away. One of the sort of fundamentally existential things about him, so that he seems to be absolutely the right inventor of existentialism, after Kierkegaard, by the way, where I think he might have pulled it, but is that he seemed to have fallen in love with countries via women. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a truly existential way of falling in love with a country is to personify it through a person. So he would go to New York and then find a woman in New York to be New York, and then fall madly in love, truly in love, mm-hmm. with a woman who was New York. Mm-hmm. And then he did it in Russia and had a gigantic love affair with a Muscovite that actually got him in some trouble. And then he did it again, where, in Japan?
Yes, that's right. He fell in love with his interpreters quite often. Yeah.
Was but, it a I way mean, of I think being it's... Japan and being Russia and mm-hmm. being New York?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent way of getting to know a culture myself. The thing is that he was a writer above all.
Right.
And I don't think sex ever interested Sartre very much. He says right. that himself. He really wasn't particular. He says somewhere, I wasn't very interested in copulation. I was much more interested in lying beside a woman and caressing her. He also admits that he was much more interested in seduction than actually what came after.
Yeah.
But for a writer, I think he found that, you know, you undress a woman and get the bed business over with, and after that you're left with the intimacy. And you really know a person in a way that you don't before you see them undressed. And for him, in his defense, because he really wasn't a Kennedy. I mean, he really didn't want, you know, Kennedy wanted sex madly, it seems, from his biographies. Sartre was interested in women.
And the dialogue.
Genuinely interested in dialogue and understanding women. I mean, when you think of the people who Sartre... I think we should remind people just how famous Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre were. You know, from 1945 to 1968, existentialism was the buzzword. It was the philosophy internationally across the world, in the Third World too. Sartre was such a hero that when Beauvoir and Sartre went to China and Japan, you know, they had people trying to touch their sleeve. They were mobbed at the airport. When they went to Cuba, when they went to Brazil, they were like pop stars. And for me in Australia, for you in America, I mean, we read those memoirs. We were fascinated by that relationship. Feminist hero, Beauvoir, Sartre.
And a man of principle. And when it was difficult for him to take positions, he took the difficult position.
Yes, so as public intellectuals and so on, I still to this day regard them as heroes, and I wish we had more intellectuals now who would speak out about things in the way they did, because it cost them. Mm-hmm. They received hate mail.
Yes.
It was difficult. During the Algerian War in the 1950s, their lives were in danger. But what I was wanting to say was they could therefore have mixed with, you know, the social elite of the world. And who did Sartre choose to spend his time with? You know, Monday lunch with Vanda, Monday evening with Olga, Tuesday morning breakfast with Beauvoir, Tuesday evening with his mother. His timetable was worked out like a dentist's schedule. I mean, and it was with these women, young women, who you and I don't think are particularly interesting. And he did not have lunch with Picasso all that often and so on, to their great disappointment, Picasso and others, because I find that intriguing. Why would this man choose to surround himself by these young women and rarely socialize with others? I think it was a real prop for him. It made him feel loved. It made mm-hmm. him feel important. It gave him a sort of security.
He really needed to be loved.
Mm.
But even in the end, the women were angry with him, because as their plays didn't work and their disappointments in their careers that he tried so hard to make work for them failed, of course. It doesn't work if you don't have sufficient talent, no matter how good the play Sartre wrote for you was. But he still tried to make their lives work. And that was more important than hobnobbing with the hoi polloi, wasn't it?
Somebody said that other men gave women jewelry, but Sartre wrote plays for them.
That's right.
Sartre wrote 9 plays. He was a well-known playwright. Today, I think, probably some of his plays stand up better than his other work. But his plays, No Exit, The Flies, mm-hmm. plays like that, were really the talk of the Paris theatre season. And what was funny was that he wrote these plays. He actually found it quite difficult to write plays. He preferred to write philosophy or novels. But he wrote these plays always with a girlfriend in mind. And she had to have the main part. He wrote the play for the girlfriend. Well, again, this was an odd thing to do because he could have had the best actress in Paris in these roles. And who he had was these young women who were his girlfriends who did not help his play.
At all.
And was he helping them? I mean, in a way, he was giving them the roles of their lives, and in a way, they weren't up to it.
They got terrible reviews.
And this was what was so difficult. For example, Claude Lanzmann's younger sister, Evelyn, wanted very much to be an actress, and Sartre wrote one of his plays for her, The Condemned of Altona. And the director said, she's not up to the part. It's a difficult part, very, very wordy, very intense. And Sartre said, no, Evelyn, no play. So Evelyn did the part, and the reviews were scathing. And in the end, that was what Linda was referring to when she said Sartre did her no good. Evelyn Lanzmann committed suicide. But it was 10 years after her affair with Sartre, so I really don't think we can blame Sartre, although people like to make the connection. He felt guilty about it, but I don't think, you know, she was a very broken woman, the sister of Lanzmann.
You can see so much of their philosophy in their lives, which of course is appropriate because it's existentialism, which has a psychological aspect. But the concept of bad faith and the master-slave dialectic, which are two of the most profound concepts in being in nothingness, are both manifested in the lives of Sartre and in de Beauvoir. Mm-hmm. But bad faith, you know, the concept of playing at something as opposed to being the something, you can see in his playing the role of this lover, this Don Juan mm-hmm. that he wanted to be. I mean, he actually said he wanted to be a Don Juan. He wanted to be this amazing Don Juan. And this effort till he died at the very end of taking care of all of these women. Mm-hmm. Look at me, I'm being Don Juan. I'm an aging Don Juan. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting thing to see this notion of bad faith having, you know, infected his ability to support himself at the end or his company, the company he kept. It's one is glad that he had de Beauvoir.
Yes, I think,
you know,
he needed her.
Company.
I think that Sartre always verged a bit on madness, really, and I think he needed Simone de Beauvoir to ground him. Because, for example, in the 1950s particularly, Sartre really started to go a bit strange. I think he was extremely... what's the word I want to hear? The Algerian War upset him hugely. I mean, it was a very dirty war, and France played a very dirty role. I mean, it was a colony which should no longer have been a colony, and France didn't want to let go of it. And the French army were torturing Arabs in the most disgusting way. The torture, I think, is really an amazing aspect of the Algerian War. Tortures which you can hardly imagine. And the French press was covering it up, except for the magazine that Beauvoir and Sartre had founded in 1945 called Les Temps Modernes, Modern Times, which was very honest about the torture. And during the 1950s, they were rather hated figures in France. And they considered them, they felt that they were in exile in their own country. It was a very difficult time. And I think Sartre felt that being a writer was a self-indulgent thing to be. He would have much preferred to have been, you know, Che Guevara or somebody. And in order to... I think he was profoundly depressed. He had, I would say, a chronic depression, which he dealt with by taking speed. And in the 1950s, quite a lot of journalists took stuff called Corydron, which was an amphetamine, an upper. But they would take a kind of half tablet to get them going. And Sartre got to the point where he was swallowing an entire tube of this stuff, one after the other, just bung them in his mouth, you know, until his tongue went white. And it made him write manically. The pen would race across the page. He and Beauvoir never used a typewriter. And he would feel, it would make him feel that there was nothing more important than writing and that he was going to do nothing less than to save the world. And then in the evening when he stopped writing at 8 o'clock at night, he then took, you know, half a bottle of whiskey he would then consume to slow him down a bit. And Beauvoir talks about how his words just became, confused. And then to get to sleep, he would take not one or two or three, but four or five major sleeping pills. So the man was living off uppers and downers and drugs. And at the end of his life, he paid a heavy price for this. I mean, the last 10 years of his life, he was a mess health-wise and also blind. He was blind from 1973 till his death in 1980, which was the most terrible thing for a writer and a reader to be. And very hard for Simone de Beauvoir to see this, to see the man who had always been, even if he was a little man, to her he was a big man, a very strong man who could look things in the face. And he didn't complain about his illness or his blindness, but she hated seeing him sort of shuffle along so dependently and so pathetically necessarily, you know.
Shall we talk about, we want to open up to some questions, so we can do that now.
I was also going to read a little tiny bit, just to give them a slight flavor of, if that's okay, just very quickly.
Fine.
I just wanted to say that they met in 1929, and then a few weeks later, Sartre went off on his military service that you still have to do in France, so that lasted 2 years. And then after that, they were both philosophy teachers, and at first you get sent to the provinces, the dreaded provinces, because a Parisian thinks that nowhere outside Paris is, you know, the real world. And she got sent to Marseille in the south, which to her was as bad as being sent on a convict ship to Australia. You know, this was exile. and then eventually she was in Rouen and Sartre was in Le Havre. But for 8 years, the first 8 years of their relationship, they were always living in shabby hotels near the railway station. And whenever they could, that meant in France there was no school on Wednesdays. There was school Saturday morning, but at midday you were free. So Saturday at midday and Tuesday night, in fact, they vamoosed either to the place where each other was or else they went to Paris and met in Paris. So it was a sort of 8 long years of railway stations and reading their detective novels that they were always reading. They read voraciously, but they loved detective novels. And then eventually they were both in Paris together in 1937, at last in the city that they loved together. And so this is the bit I wanted to read you. Simone de Beauvoir was away with a girlfriend on vacation, and Sartre was back in Paris. Sartre was pleased to discover the Hôtel Mistral on the Rue Celle, a tiny street between the Avenue du Maine and the Montparnasse Cemetery. It doesn't look very promising. It has a shabby stairway and moth-eaten halls, he told Beauvoir. But the rooms are large and clean, with a sofa, rug, and bookshelves on the walls. When Beauvoir came back to Paris, they moved in, taking rooms on different floors. Thus, we had all the advantages of a shared life, Beauvoir writes in her memoirs, without any of its inconveniences. Their favourite cafes, the Dome, Coupole, and Select, were close by on the Boulevard du Montparnasse. Just around the corner from the Mistral, on the Avenue du Maine, was a large noisy brasserie called the Café des Trois Mousquetaires, the Café of the Three Musketeers. For the next few years, these cafés were as familiar to them as their hotel rooms. What never wearies me, Sartre would write, is to sit on chairs which belong to nobody, or if you like, to everybody, in front of tables which belong to nobody. That's why I go and work in cafés. I achieve a kind of solitude and abstraction. Now that they lived in the same city, they had to be careful not to encroach on each other's private space. Their days were strictly scheduled. It's interesting that freedom doesn't mean the same as spontaneity. In fact, the more free you are, the less spontaneous you can be because you can't barge into each other's hotel rooms. Mm-hmm. Their days were strictly scheduled. On the whole, they didn't see each other before they left to teach in the mornings. Sartre tended to be irascible when he first got up and preferred his own company at breakfast. "I can hardly endure even the beaver," he confessed in his journal. "I have been known, when she would be waiting for me at the Café Raleigh, to pop in to the Café des Trois Mousquetaires and quickly gulp down a coffee and croissant in order to remain for a moment still wrapped up in myself and last night's dreams." Their afternoon writing hours were equally sacred. Lunchtimes and evenings after 8 p.m. were their sociable hours. They had long ago decided that the most satisfying form of communication was tête-à-tête, twosomes. If Sartre was eating with Vanda at the Coupole, or if Beauvoir was seeing Olga at the Dome, there was no question of the other spontaneously joining them. And time limits were sacrosanct. Their friends constantly complained that when their time was up, they were expected to melt away, making way for the next person. Well, that just gives you a taste of their rather strange social life.
So, questions for Hazel or for...
I'm not aware of any children. Can you talk about if there are any children from...
Yes. No, they didn't. They didn't have children and didn't really like children much. I think it's difficult for writers to, you know, it would have been very difficult for them to have the relationship that they had and to have children. But luckily, I suppose, Beauvoir didn't want any, so the issue didn't come up.
It seems to me that when I studied existentialism, I thought it was such a life-affirming philosophy and something that really did empower me outside of feminist movements, or it was for anybody.
Yes.
And it seems that it's been caricatured, particularly in this country. And can you speak a little bit to that? How did that affect them? Were they aware of that? That, you know, people, there's always that caricature that existentialists all wore black and were miserable all the time. Can you talk a little bit how they dealt with that, or if they were aware that people made those caricatures about them?
It's a good question, and they were. I mean, you see, what happened was, first of all, the war, which was a very grim time. You know, Nazi occupation in Paris, German soldiers everywhere, Jews being taken at dawn. They had Jewish friends who were taken to camps. They had resistant friends, friends who were in the resistance movement, who were, you know, cruelly tortured and then killed. So I think that Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre realized during the Second World War that freedom wasn't as simple as they had thought. They had thought that it was sort of individual freedom, you could do what you want. And suddenly they saw that history hugely affected freedom. And then straight after the war in 1945, in fact, you can almost name the night, Sartre gave a lecture one evening in October 1945 in Paris, and he was mobbed. And this became, from then on, that night on, they were in the newspapers, they had reporters sort of taking photographs in front of them. It was suddenly reported which cafe they were hanging out at. And I think existentialism took on, it came instantly to America. Nobody quite knew what it meant, but it was a buzzword and it was a philosophy. And indeed, the newspapers, the tabloid papers, made it into a farce. You know, this is where the existentialists are hanging out, at this existentialist cafe, and committing existentialist suicides. And everything was existentialist. Nobody knew what it meant. And in fact, Sartre commented on that in his lecture. He said, this word's become suddenly, that was before he was famous, the night before he was, the night of, he became famous, he said, existentialism has become a buzzword. And I even heard that a woman swore recently and said, oh, I don't know what possessed me, I must be becoming an existentialist. So, I mean, the idea was that existentialists were sort of nasty, crazy people who swore violently and were pessimistic and so on. And the point that Sartre was making in this lecture was that he didn't understand this. To him, existentialism was a very life-affirming philosophy. He said it's all about choice. It's all about freedom. It's all about the burden of freedom. He says it's true that people don't want to embrace their freedom. They're scared of it. It is quite scary. That's why, I mean, a big thing in existentialism is to talk about sort of freedom. You're at the edge of a cliff facing an abyss because you're responsible for your choices. You're responsible. There's nobody else you can blame except yourself, and that makes it a burden. And so he talks a lot about the angst of existentialism. And Sartre says, you know, there is no such thing. First of all, there is no God, so there is no such thing as human nature, which is why he uses the word existentialism. He says existence comes before essence. In other words, you are what you make yourself. You are your existence. You are the sum total of your actions. So you can't say I'm lazy as if I was born lazy. That's my nature. That's your choice. You've said it. That's your choice. And he does, he says, you know, so many people say they would have written a great book if they hadn't had three children. Well, he says, you either write a good book or you don't write a great book. Don't make excuses. So Beauvoir and Sartre were very, very big on this thing about excuses, which is basically bad faith. And he says it is affirming, it is life-affirming, because you do have choices. Even if you're going to be hanged in the morning, according to Sartre, you have some sort of choice, which is how you react to being hanged in the morning. Also, you can smile, or you could take it badly.
It also kind of got, in America, caught up with the beatnik movement.
Yeah.
And the beatniks wore black. And they, you know, bang the bongos and stuff like that. So the sort of attire and jazz and the ethos of existentialism got sort of mixed up stylistically with existentialism. And then that's nobody right. really bothered to read the philosophy and do the hard work. And then you sort of get titles like Being in Nothingness. God, that can't be good, you know? So you read headlines and it says Being in Nothingness and God is Dead and... You know, you want to
it's true that existentialism came into being at exactly the same time, October 1945, as all the jazz sellers. You know, the minute the liberation and the Nazis packed off and left Paris, these jazz sellers and wonderful jazz dance halls, basement places sprang up in Paris. And so they tended to be associated with existentialism. And they had jazz friends, you know, too.
Allen Ginsberg doing Howl, and suddenly the best minds of my generation were, you know, existentialists, you know? So it all sort of got merged, and people didn't sort of do the work to figure out that there was actually some thinking behind this that could be interpreted in a difficult but life-affirming way. That is to say that still it's easier to take an organized religion, just do whatever they say and go to heaven afterwards, you know? It's still hard work to actually think out a solution for yourself in terms of making choices. In fact, the great literal quote is, we stand in terror at the responsibility of our choices, right? Because if somebody like a Scientologist can literally just tell you what to do and all you have to do is like deal with the thetans, you know, it's always easier. But on the other hand, you know, free will.
Yes, I have a question here. When I came to the chapter when Sartre adopted
Where are
the
you?
Daughter,
ah.
when Sartre adopted a daughter, I was trying to sort of understand why he did that. And then the daughter started, of course, as someone that was asking for advice. And I think they became lovers at one time. But then why did he adopt the daughter? And then later on, when he was close to death, some decisions were made about some of the objects that he had that I thought Simone de Beauvoir should have made. That's when I was reading the book. So can you shed a little light on the daughter?
Yes, well, the thing is, it's true that Sartre in 1965 adopted a daughter, and this surprised the entire France. It made the headlines of all the tabloid newspapers because Sartre was famous in various books for saying, you know, fatherhood, paternity is a sham, says Sartre. No, the thing was that he did need an heir. I think it was his publisher who one day said to him, who's going to inherit your estate when you die? And he said, well, Simone de Beauvoir, I suppose. And he said, well, you know, she's much the same age as you are. This isn't, and you don't have children. Do you realize that it will go to your family? Meaning rather distant family, really, cousins and so on. They were the only ones who would have been alive. So Sartre, for the sake of his estate, decided to adopt the youngest of all his women. And so she became Arlette El-Kaïm. She was Algerian-Jewish, Sartre. And what's tragic, the story at the end does become rather tragic because that Sartre gave her all the legal rights in doing that, and Simone de Beauvoir, who was not his wife, had none. And it turned rather ugly because Arlette, like most of the women around Sartre, didn't like Simone de Beauvoir, jealous of Simone de Beauvoir's place in his life. And so she really used her power and abused her power. And she had all the legal rights on her side. So after Sartre died, Arlette cleared out his apartment and took the papers and took the furniture. And she owns the copyright of all Sartre's material. So actually, Simone de Beauvoir even had to ask her for, you know, permission to publish this and that. So it was very painful for Simone de Beauvoir.
The amount of deception that you describe in his relationship with Simone de Beauvoir comes as a surprise to me. I wonder if I always thought of him as a candid, penetrating analyst of human relations. Did he ever deal with his own deceptions, either in his fiction or in his philosophy?
But I don't think he particularly deceived Simone de Beauvoir.
Everyone else?
All the other women he did. A little bit. I must admit he did a bit, but no. Yes. Well, I can't really answer the question. It was a complete contradiction with his philosophy. And you're not the first to be stunned and disappointed by it. I don't try to justify it or whitewash it. My job as a writer is to tell you the facts as I saw them, and I decided not to give you my own judgments, partly because, you know, Tuesday I would hate them and Wednesday I would admire them ardently, so my judgments changed, and they do still. I do admire them enormously as public intellectuals, also as people who lived life incredibly intensely. To this day, I mean, they inspire me in the sense that very few people have worked as hard, been as politically active, had as many love affairs, travelled as much, read as much, been as curious about the world, had such loyal friends, changed their times. Yeah, they didn't. I think one of the problems I had that dealing with their relationship, as I do in this book, it's not really a biography, it's a real close portrait of the two, you know, and their lovers, because I had to look at the lovers to look at their relationship. And I did understand from the very beginning that I was looking at the most tawdry aspect of their lives. And this was a worry for me. Every single day I grappled with this because I did admire them, I do admire them. And so I took pains to paint in the larger picture to give enough sense of how hard they worked and how they changed their times and what their ideas were, because I can't pretend I was really disappointed too by the shabby stuff. I met Simone de Beauvoir, by the way. I interviewed her back in 76, and when I was in my 20s and deeply involved in the women's movement, and when my life was hugely shaped, like Linda's, by, you know, they probably more than Linda's, I don't know, but I, like Linda, I very much admired this couple. So for me, in my middle age, to come back and look at them again was a really interesting exercise. But I wanted to be open. I didn't know what I'd find. I moved to Paris, I took my stuff, and I thought, I will travel this journey. I don't know what I will come out thinking.
I'll tell you one thing that makes you reconcile to it a little bit, is that he was very clear with de Beauvoir from the beginning that he was never going to be able to have a monogamous relationship, yes, ever. and that he felt that it would, if she believed that he could, it would ruin their relationship, and it was critical to him. They have a lifelong relationship. So that he had to know her. She had to know him and who he was. That he would do everything to keep their relationship lifelong, and that he wanted to be able to separate and come together so that they could stay lifelong and never hit a dull routine. And he used every philosophical and intellectual tool at his disposal to make that glorious. And it sells, you know? As a woman, it's terrifying because of the degree to which it sells. But at the same time, he mythified her by doing that. He gave her an identity. He gave her fame. He essentially liberated her from what would have been a more middle-class life. He gave her text and narrative to her work. And he, even though he gave her enormous pain as well, we don't know that she wouldn't have found that some other way, but he mythified her. He gave her a sense of self so much larger than she would have had otherwise.
I agree with that.
That also created all of these other followers for her, and 7 books and hundreds of hours of tears.
He gave her the subject matter of her memoirs, really. Was
the subject matter of her whole text of her life.
And also even the other relationships. Somebody, the guy who wrote a stupid review in the New Yorker.
But there was no point at which he ever said to her, I will be yours without other women in your life. Now, his other needs, which is that he needed to have a constant stream of contingent relationships of women that adored him for whatever compensatory neurotic reasons that he needed them, those were the women he lied to that he needed to have in his life.
Yes.
Yet, even though he constantly... He got them to need him and then was exhausted by the degree to which they were dependent. He got them to be dependent on them and then became exhausted, as you brilliantly described, by the degree to which they then became dependent on him, because they weren't as deft at Simone at disappearing, developing lives of their own, and becoming somewhat independent of him. They literally became dependent. I must say the extraordinary thing is that he didn't abandon them.
Yes.
Even though he lied to them, he ultimately ended up carrying out his responsibilities to them to the end of their days. And that's where the master-slave relationship comes in. Because they were dependent on him, and then... he was dependent on them, and they were dependent on him, and then ultimately he was dependent on them for his self-concept. So even though there were lies, they were utterly interdependent. There was a power component in it. He needed to show that these beautiful women were dependent on him and he had power over them. But at the same time, he was dependent on them, and they were mutually dependent. He lied because they would leave him if he didn't lie. But they were mutually dependent on each other. That was neurotic.
The point I just wanted to make quickly was before there's a question there, I know, was that the fellow in the New Yorker said, and I think a few reviewers have taken this line, poor old Simone de Beauvoir, what a victim. How often she was jealous and how often she was in tears. And it seemed to this man, Louis Menand, that Simone de Beauvoir would have been a lot happier if she could have had a monogamous relationship with Sartre. And I thought, typical chauvinist attitude here, really rather sexist. Simone de Beauvoir knew what she was choosing, and she chose Sartre, firstly. And secondly...
And consistently.
Thank God she had affairs, because it has often been... Simone de Beauvoir herself said this. She said, Sartre is incredibly exciting everywhere, except in bed. And the fact is, thank goodness for her that she had Nelson Algren, Claude Lanzmann, etc., etc.
And when Nelson Algren offered the whole thing to her, she chose Sartre again.
Yes, so it was her choice. Right, this man here.
How did you find the relationship in Simone de Beauvoir's memoirs to the facts as you found in your other research? In other words, how truthful and candid is she in her memoirs on her relationship with Sartre? Could you talk a little about
that? No, that's also a very good question. And you see, first of all, we read her memoirs and we were absolutely fascinated by this relationship, which seemed to give up everything. And I similarly, when I interviewed her, she answered the question so fast. She never hesitated. And I was saying, you know, was it true that you were never jealous, you and Sartre? And she gave me this pat answer. And even then in my 20s, I came away thinking, she's sort of fallen for the myth herself. Well, certainly when I worked on it and I spoke to the lovers who still survived and the friends who still survived, and I read hundreds and hundreds of letters from Sartre to his girlfriends that nobody has ever read before, I saw that she certainly did idealize the relationship. It's not at all true that she did not feel jealousy. And so I felt that, you know, I was the ethic of my book is the transparency that they always wanted. I mean, they should have approved of my mission, which was transparency, which they claimed they were trying to live by. And in fact, there was quite a difference, yeah. We fell for the relationship, and I still admire many aspects of it. But there's this point in the preface where I just say, it's two sentences, I just say that when Beauvoir's memoirs began to appear in the 1960s and 70s, those heady years of social experimentation, innumerable young people took Sartre and Beauvoir's open relationship as their model. I did too. When I read Beauvoir's memoirs in the late 60s, I was exhilarated, intoxicated, one might say. She made the impossible seem possible. Didn't we all want an intellectual partner with whom we could share our work, ideas, and slightest thoughts? Didn't everyone want to write in Paris cafes amid the clatter of coffee cups and the hubbub of voices and spend their summers in Rome in complicated but apparently harmonious foursomes? Who wanted monogamy when one could have freedom and stability, love affairs and commitment? This was me in my preface when I'm sort of fairly honest about what I was doing.
And that's why the book is so delicious, and I suggest all of you read it right away, because I couldn't put it down. I've scribbled all over
she
it.
She has to. I've seen her. She's completely messed up my book.
And writing all over the margin.
I love it when people do that, because I really do just want to tell you that, I mean, she's analysing in a way that I want people to do, but that I personally don't do. I just tell
She
the
leaves
story.
It for us to be scribbling all over the margins,
the
all
stuff
of our
about
theories.
Dependence and codependence and all this is what we feel like speculating on, but I certainly don't do it at all in the book.
But it's so juicy, I have to tell you. You can't wait to go home and read it. And thank you for coming on tonight.
Thank you very much.
Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and is made possible through the generosity of the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation. Additional support is provided by Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Navigant Consulting, the National Endowment for the Humanities, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, City National Bank, KPMG, and Wired Magazine. Media support provided by KJAZZ, 88.1 FM, KCRW 89.9 FM, KCET, and LA 36.